Welcome to the Reasoned Hope Podcast. In this podcast, we explore the intellectual credibility of the Christian faith. We seek to show how the central hope found in Jesus Christ is not only rational, but that the Christian worldview makes sense of our experience, our deepest longings, and our intuitions about the world. Thanks for listening, and we hope today's episode is both encouraging and challenging to you, whether you are a believer or a skeptic.
Welcome, and thank you for joining me for today's episode of the Reasoned Hope Podcast. If this is a podcast that is encouraging to you or that you enjoy or that you know other people who are interested in it, please spread the word. Let them know where they can find it. You can find this podcast on all major podcasting platforms. And also feel free to leave a positive review if this is a podcast that you enjoy as well. ReasonedHopePodcast.com is the website. ReasonedHopePodcast@gmail.com is the contact email address, where you can send questions, comments, and other things of that sort. In today's episode, we're going to be looking at a very significant question regarding the existence of God. And I think it's important when you're discussing the question of God's existence, sometimes it's necessary to make a positive case for God's existence if people are open to hearing it. Other times, however, it's important to address certain objections that people bring up. And these objections can come in different forms. And one form that some objections can come in are called a priori objections. And if something is a priori, that's just a Latin phrase that refers to something that is a self-evident truth, or it's a claim that is made prior to examining the evidence for something. Another way that you can think about it is that it is a claim that you can make that you believe is true apart from any experience or investigation that you have had or conducted. So for example, an a priori truth that we know is that bachelors are unmarried males. So a bachelor is an unmarried male. That is something that is true by its very definition. You don't have to go and investigate every single case of a bachelor to figure out if all bachelors are unmarried males. This is a self-evident truth that you know by reason. Another example could be someone could say, I don't believe in the miracles of the Bible because miracles are impossible. Miracles don't happen. That's another sort of a priori way of reasoning. It's not reasonable to believe in a miracle because miracles don't happen. And maybe someone thinks that because they don't believe in the supernatural. And so anytime they're confronted with a supernatural claim, they've got that a priori objection ready that says, well, there's nothing supernatural, so something else is going on there. Sometimes people will raise a priori objections to God's existence. And so this would be an objection or a claim that prior to even examining the evidence for God or arguments for the existence of God, this would be something that would say, we have reasons for doubting the existence of God before we even get to that part of it. And so in this episode, I want to examine one a priori objection to God's existence. And this can come up with some frequency. It is the claim that human beings are simply not in an epistemic position. In other words, we don't have the ability to know if God exists. So human beings are limited in our knowledge in such a way, to such an extent, that we don't even have the ability to know if God exists or not. And this is commonly known as the view of agnosticism. So agnosticism can come in two broadly main forms. And this can be characterized in different ways, but the way I'm going to refer to it is soft agnosticism and hard agnosticism. So soft agnosticism is the claim that one personally is not sure if God exists or not. So this could be someone, if they're asked about whether they believe in God, they would say, I really don't know. They might be open to the fact that they could know. They might be open to the fact that there is a God, but they're just not currently at a place where they are sure. So that's soft agnosticism. Hard agnosticism is a stronger claim. It's the claim that no one can know whether or not God exists. So we don't even have the ability to know whether or not God exists. So the difference here between these two is crucial, and it has implications on how you might go about talking to someone about where they're at, whether or not they adopt soft or hard agnosticism. Because someone who embraces soft agnosticism, they may be open to actually investigating the question of God's existence. Maybe they haven't really looked into arguments and evidence or reasons to think there's a God, but they might be open to doing that. And they may have arrived at this position for a variety of reasons. And some people are at this place because they personally don't feel like they've adequately considered the issue to have a grounded view on it. But a person who embraces hard agnosticism, like I said, is making a very strong claim. And they're claiming that no one can know whether or not God exists. And so in this episode, I'm going to be primarily focusing on strong agnosticism or hard agnosticism. And that's largely because soft agnosticism can be addressed by discussing the evidence and the arguments for God's existence with someone, because soft agnosticism leaves open the possibility for knowledge about God, but hard agnosticism does not. And if hard agnosticism is true, that poses serious problems for our ability to know if God exists or not. And it poses problems for people claiming to know that there's a God. So it's important to address this and to think through it and whether or not it is a serious a priori objection to the existence of God. So I think a good place to start with this is just to ask, what are the reasons that some people put forth for accepting hard agnosticism, the idea that no one can know whether or not there's a God? And people are going to differ on this because some people may not be able to really give an answer as to why they think that's the case. It may be that that's just something that they have adopted, but they haven't thought about or reflected on very deeply. And if that's the case, then you would have to kind of engage with them and find out, well, why have you ended up here? What convinces you that that view is true? But other people are more prepared to actually give a defense for this view, why they think this view is true. So the characterization that I'm going to provide, I'm not going to say that these are the reasons that everyone who embraces hard agnosticism would give, but I think it covers the general reasons that most people would probably go to, even if they don't describe it in the exact same way that I describe it here. So in general, people who adopt a strong agnostic view are going to argue along the lines of the fact that human beings are limited in significant ways that prevent us from having access to knowledge of God's existence. So some people argue that there's just such a vast amount of knowledge that human beings do not yet possess about the universe and even about ourselves. And so if that's true, they say, how is it that we can claim to know anything about God's existence? And it seems to people who adopt this view that it would be presumptuous and arrogant to think that we know if there's a God or that we're in a position to. And frequently it can be characterized as a humble position, a more humble position to say, well, we don't really know and we really can't know because we're so limited, rather than to adopt the view that we know there's a God. So some people think it's a little bit arrogant to make that kind of claim. Now, others may state the view from another angle. Some may say that human beings are only just beginning their evolutionary development. And so in the grand scheme of the universe, humans really haven't been around that long. So it would seem odd if we're in this position for us to make claims about such big questions as God's existence when we are still in our infancy, so to speak. So in addition to these above two perspectives, other people may add that the subject matter of the question complicates things even further. So it's one thing to claim to have knowledge about elements of the universe such as gravity and biology and human society. But when we get to the question of God, this is what's called a metaphysical question. So in other words, this is a question which is beyond the physical world. It's a different type of thing than gravity, biology, human society. So because it's not in the same category as physical things which can be verified, this poses a problem for some people in making strong claims about these kinds of questions. And further, some are going to say, well, there's just so much disagreement about God. Look at all the religions of the world. They have different ideas of God. So this includes whether or not there is a God to begin with, but also what God is like. So for these kind of above reasons, some argue just we simply can't make claims to know whether or not God exists or what God is like. It's like there's a great ditch or gulf between human beings and the knowledge of God. And this ditch is not something that can be crossed. So that is the situation that some people who embrace strong agnosticism would say that we're in. And I just want to read a quote by Schellenberg. He's a philosopher who adopts this sort of agnostic position. And I think this quote is significant because it brings out some of these themes that we've already talked about here. So he says this in his book, The Wisdom to Doubt. He says, quote, "It is obvious that in cultures where science is undeveloped, we do not expect anyone to be discerning truths in electrodynamics or particle physics. But then perhaps something similar applies where truths about ultimate things are concerned. Perhaps many rich layers of development and maturation of very demanding sorts requiring much time need to be laid down before any human being can hope to be able to access such truths. Do we have any reason to think that such growth has already occurred? It certainly seems not. There is plenty of reason to be in doubt about whether the world has so far traveled any great distance along the path of preparation for religious discovery. Indeed, we may well be stuck somewhere far back in the beginning stages of development." End quote. So as you can see there, Schellenberg raises this same issue. He's saying that if we go to a culture where the discipline of science is undeveloped, you wouldn't go there asking people about scientific truths about particle physics and electrodynamics and astronomy and chemistry and all these sorts of things, because the people in that culture, if the discipline of science is undeveloped there, they're not going to even be in a position to know how to answer those questions. They don't even have the concepts to think about those types of things. And he's using this as an analogy to say maybe we're in a similar position when it comes to questions about what he says ultimate things. He's talking about metaphysical questions. He's talking about religious questions. And he's suggesting that maybe we are in an undeveloped position in regards to these things. And it may be that it's going to require a long time for us to even get to the point where we could be able to have access to knowledge about these kinds of truths about God. And he suggests that we don't have any reason to think that this has already happened at our current stage of development. And so his position is a position of agnosticism, of doubt. We should not think that we're in a position to know these kinds of truths about God, to know whether or not God exists, and to know what God is like. So this just sort of is a brief overview of a strong agnostic view and some reasons why some people may embrace this view. Now, how should we respond to this? How should we think through this? As, you know, from a Christian perspective, certainly, But how should we think about this in general, even if you're not a Christian? Is this a good way to think about questions about God and whether or not God exists? Is hard agnosticism or a strong agnostic view, is this a reason to doubt that we can even know if there's a God and what God is like? And I'm going to just suggest some reasons why I think it is not a good objection to God's existence. And the first one is really this. It's that hard agnosticism, when you think about it, it's actually a self-defeating perspective. And so the person who's claiming hard agnosticism, they're going to have to be very careful to avoid the trap of holding a self-defeating view. And it's difficult to see how they're going to avoid doing this. Because the claim, no one can know whether or not God exists, is really a claim that no one can have knowledge of God. But notice that if we accept this statement, no one can have knowledge of God, we have just helped ourselves to a knowledge claim about God. And that knowledge claim is that nobody can have knowledge of God. So notice that. When someone is saying that no one can have knowledge of God, they are making a knowledge claim about God. So if it's true that no one can have knowledge of God, then we can't even know the truth of that statement because it is a claim about God. So that's the first response here, is that depending on how this view is characterized, it can end up being a self-defeating perspective. And that's a problem. If you have a view that is self-defeating, then it can't be used as an a priori objection to God's existence. So that would be one way to respond to this, is that, well, because this view is self-referentially incoherent, it's self-defeating, this objection can be set aside as something that would prevent a person from knowing if God exists or not. So this means that the question of God's existence and whether or not God's existence is even plausible is a question to be answered by looking at the actual case for God's existence. And this means that you're going to have to look at the arguments and the evidence that have been put forward for the existence of God as opposed to the non-existence of God. And it also means that you're going to have to consider the positive case to be made for atheism, because atheism is a case of its own to be made. And so this first point is really saying that in a very significant way, strong agnosticism is a self-defeating perspective. And so you can't use a self-defeating perspective to dismiss the whole discussion of God's existence and the evidence for God's existence. And that's really significant, because if this is a self-defeating view, then it really is not a serious a priori objection to God's existence, and it can be set aside. Now, some of this can also depend upon how a person articulates a strong agnostic view. Because another thing to consider is that some people will characterize a strong agnostic view in terms of probability. And we've touched on this a little bit already, but this is really kind of the third point here, is that a strong agnostic view may rest on a misunderstanding of probability and how probability works. So we see this in how some people will appeal to the vast amount of knowledge that humans do not yet possess, and this idea of the infancy of humanity in our evolutionary development. So these are two ways of arguing that we've already touched on, but they essentially appeal to kind of a probabilistic reasoning here. And I think it's important to see that we can take this same sort of reasoning that people use to promote strong agnosticism, and we can apply this to any question or claim. So if we set the question of God's existence aside, and we just take this same method of reasoning, we'll see that it doesn't work in other areas. And then we can ask, if it doesn't work in other areas, then why would it work when we apply it to the question of God? So, for example, how do we know that George Washington was the first president of the United States? You could argue that history is actually a more complicated discipline than most people realize, because it's possible that there's a whole host of information and evidence that we don't yet have and may never have about George Washington and the founding of America. Some historians will actually claim that history doesn't give us real knowledge of the past. It doesn't give us real objective knowledge of the past. Rather, some historians will say that history is just the reconstruction of the past. And this reconstruction is something that historians impose upon the data of the past. So notice that we are applying the same logic here. The appeal is made to all the possible knowledge that we don't yet possess about early American history. Who are we to say we have all the facts of this period? And then the conclusion is drawn, we cannot know if George Washington was the first president of the United States. Now, many people will say that conclusion is faulty. And why would they say that? Well, I think it's because we obviously have good reasons to think George Washington was the first president of the United States. And so the case for that conclusion is built upon the reasons for thinking that the claim is true. Now, some people are going to, you know, who promote hard agnosticism will claim that knowledge of God is highly improbable, and it's so improbable that no one can attain it. But this is to actually misunderstand how probability works. Because you don't judge the probability of something based on all the possible information that you don't have. Rather, you judge the probability of something based on the evidence and the reasons you have for thinking the claim is true. So, we accept that George Washington was the first president of the United States because this claim is beyond reasonable doubt. The historical evidence is there to support the claim, even if we don't have every single piece of evidence that we could have had to justify the claim. Because certainly it is possible that there's a whole host of information and evidence that would have made the claim of George Washington as the first president, and you can take any element of history. It's certainly possible that there's a vast amount of information that we could have had, but that we don't. But you don't go just from that to the conclusion that, well, then we can't know what really happened. And so, in the same way, there is a good case to be made for the existence of God. From a philosophical perspective, from a scientific perspective, from a historical perspective. And I would argue that if you want to speak in the language of probability, this case for God's existence, it shows that God's existence is highly probable rather than being highly improbable. So the overall point here, if I can illustrate it another way, if you think of all the knowledge in the world as on a pie chart, and if you accept that human beings only possess a very small amount of this total knowledge, so think about just a sliver in the pie chart, and that's the knowledge that the human race possesses about the world. Now, the way that you think about the probability of a claim being true is you don't look at the vast amount of knowledge in the pie chart that we don't yet possess, and then draw the conclusion that thinking that a certain claim is true is just so improbable and so unjustified given all that we don't know. You don't reason that way. You first have to think about, well, what do we know in the sliver of knowledge that we have? You have to look at that to judge the probability of a given claim being true. And what some people do when it comes to the knowledge of God is that they're saying, well, because we only have certain information about God in the sliver, and there may be all this other information that we don't have in the rest of the pie chart, therefore, God's existence is so improbable and so out of our reach that we could never know. That's to misunderstand probability. It's to misunderstand how to think about the evidence and the justification for a claim. You look at what we do know in the sliver of the pie chart, and you reason from that to say, do we have good reason to think that there is a God or not? And you have to look at that. You can't dismiss the case to be made for God just by appealing to all the information that we don't know. And that illustration with pointing to history just shows that you can apply this same sort of reasoning to historical claims, but people don't accept that because they recognize that you have to look at the evidence that we do have from a given period of history and draw your conclusions from that evidence. You don't make an appeal to all the evidence that we don't have or that we could have had. So that's really the main issue with how people argue from a probabilistic standpoint for a strong agnostic view. So what about this idea of the infancy of humanity? I think that the appeal to the infancy of humanity does not justify hard agnosticism either. So let's just accept for the sake of argument that humans are evolved creatures, that Darwin was correct, and all kind of the worldview baggage behind that claim. Let's just accept that for the sake of argument, because that's how people who adopt this view are going to, that's where they're going to start from to make this case. So how is it that the person making this claim knows what level of development that humans would have to be at in order to obtain knowledge of God? Isn't such a person, again, making a claim about what we can and cannot know about God? It seems to follow from that that the person making this claim would have some knowledge of God. But I think the problem here is how do we get from this idea of infancy, the infancy of humanity, to the conclusion of hard agnosticism? I don't see how this follows. It seems to rest on a hidden assumption that the person knows a specific level of development that is required before humans can obtain knowledge of God. But where does someone get this information? Where does someone get this knowledge? And that's what isn't explained here. So it seems that if you accept the premise of this, of the infancy of humanity, that we're just so undeveloped in our understanding about the universe and our philosophical understanding and our religious understanding, if you accept all that, then this is going to cut the legs out from under this assumption. And that's the assumption, again, that you are aware of some specific level of development that human beings would have to be at in order to start making some types of more grounded claims about God and religion and things like this. So the core issue here is that the person is claiming to have access to some sort of privileged information about human development and how this relates to the knowledge of God. But if we accept their assumptions, if you accept their assumptions here, then it seems to remove any ability to have such privileged information. And that's a problem. There's an assumption hidden in this type of perspective that is not justified if we take the perspective seriously. So maybe we could look at this from another angle. Maybe we could revise it to say that it's not a claim to know a specific level of human development that would be required to have knowledge of God. Rather, it's a claim that it's merely possible that humanity has not yet achieved a sufficient state of intellectual, moral, and spiritual development to obtain knowledge of God and His existence. This is more along the lines of what Schellenberg, the philosopher that I quoted earlier, it's more along the lines of what he's saying. Now, I think it's important here to make a key distinction, And this is the distinction between possibility and plausibility. So it's certainly possible that this claim is true, but it doesn't seem plausible that it's true. Plausibility refers to the reasonableness or the likelihood that a given view is true. So the person making this claim is making a very general claim, but again, a very strong claim. And they're going to have to do more to show why that view should be accepted than just appealing to possibility. And then in addition, the case for the existence of God must be judged on its own merits instead of being dismissed by an appeal to possibility. So just because someone can say, well, it's possible that humanity has not been developed enough or around long enough to reach a certain place where they could have the ability to know about God in the ways that a lot of religions seem to claim for more certain, that possibility does not mean that view is actually correct. It's one option that may be out there as a possibility. But just because it's a possibility, it's a whole nother thing for that view to be true and for it to be reasonable to accept. And that's really the main point here. Now, just to qualify this, Schellenberg does provide more than a mere appeal to possibility in his work. And so my aim here is not to provide a full-blown critique of his view, but it's mainly to just show how his more sophisticated view of agnosticism appears in a diminished form in lay-level discussions of agnosticism. So, but I do want to make two observations on his quote that I read earlier. So let me just read it one more time and then make a couple comments on it. So he says, quote, "It is obvious that in cultures where science is undeveloped, we do not expect anyone to be discerning truths in electrodynamics or particle physics. But then perhaps something similar applies where truths about ultimate things are concerned. Perhaps many rich layers of development and maturation of very demanding sorts requiring much time need to be laid down before any human being can hope to be able to access such truths. Do we have any reason to think that such growth has already occurred? It certainly seems not. There is plenty of reason to be in doubt about whether the world has so far traveled any great distance along the path of preparation for religious discovery. Indeed, we may well be stuck somewhere far back in the beginning stages of development." End quote. Now, one main thing that I want to focus on in that quote is that he says, "Do we have any reason to think that such growth has already occurred? It certainly seems not." And I'll just say, it seems false that we have no reason to think that humanity has an ability to discover and discern spiritual truths about God. I think the very fact that Schellenberg and other philosophers of religion can write books discussing the possibility of knowledge of God and what God is like is itself a testament to our ability to think hard about these things. And again, it's worth repeating, there is a good philosophical case to be made for the existence of God. There's a good scientific case to be made for the existence of God. There's a good historical case to be made for the existence of God. So I would just disagree with this view here. I think we have a lot of reason to think that this kind of growth, as Schellenberg puts it, has already occurred. And if that's true, then the mere appeal to a possibility that we are not in such a position is weakened. So I think that's a very important point. People spend time arguing these sorts of things and putting forth these very developed philosophical positions on agnosticism and other views about God, and they're using this sorts of reasoning to cast in doubt that we can actually know truths about God. But it's interesting that arguing in this way, developing these views, having these conversations, it really reveals the extent to which humanity has gotten to the place where we can think hard about metaphysical questions. And I think that itself is actually an evidence against this sort of view. We're not as undeveloped as this view makes it out to be. And third, I think this is just so worth repeating. We could apply this same infancy logic to other areas of inquiry and see that it just doesn't work. We already saw how it doesn't work with a historical claim like George Washington. This is not how people think about probability and claims when it comes to history. It's not the way people think about science. So we could argue that humans are still only just beginning to understand the universe. And so we're thus in our infancy when it comes to scientific knowledge. So we really shouldn't claim then to know that the universe had a beginning. We shouldn't really claim to know that we understand the law of gravity. We shouldn't really claim to know that the sun really is the center of the solar system. Now, this sort of position would get immediate pushback, and I think rightly so. And why? It's because in all these cases, we have good reasons for claiming knowledge of these things about the universe. We have good reasons to think that the universe had a beginning at the Big Bang. We have good reasons for thinking that there is such a thing as the law of gravity. We have good reasons for thinking that the sun really is the center of the solar system. So these aren't baseless hypotheses that have just been pulled out of thin air. They've been tested and they've been investigated. So if we do not apply this infancy logic to such scientific questions, why then would we apply it to the question of God's existence? It's worth thinking about that. I think that's a major weakness of this view. Now, some people may say, well, it's the concept of God itself that sort of rules out knowledge of God. So if we kind of move away from more of a focus on this infancy of humanity idea, and we just think about the concept of God, some people who promote hard agnosticism will say that since God is immaterial and there's disagreement about God, this also lends support to the idea that humans can't really know about God. So I think we just need to ask a couple of questions of this kind of perspective. So does the fact that God is immaterial rule out knowledge of God? I think it's hard to see how this is the case. We have knowledge of all sorts of immaterial things every single day. We are in contact with the immaterial realm every day of our lives. The very thoughts that you're having right now are immaterial. You can't crack open someone's brain and find thoughts there. The ideas that you're considering right now are immaterial. Your emotions are immaterial. Anytime you make a moral judgment, you're appealing to some sort of moral standard. You are apprehending a moral fact about the world, which is itself immaterial. And so, since we have knowledge of many immaterial realities, there is no good reason to think we cannot have knowledge of God if he is immaterial. God is a person, and we certainly have knowledge of persons from a human perspective. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is that the person making this claim will also have to provide specific reasons why, if God is immaterial, this means we cannot have knowledge of him. And this sort of thing happens all the time. And it's really a holdover from a view called logical positivism in philosophy that basically said if you state something, if you make a claim, and that claim is either not true by definition, so we thought earlier about how bachelors are unmarried males, that's a claim that is true by its definition. A bachelor is an unmarried male. You don't need to go look at all cases of single men and know that they're bachelors and that they're unmarried. It's something true by definition. So this view in philosophy said that if you make a claim, the only way that claim can be true and justified is either if, one, it is true by definition, or if it can be empirically verified. So in other words, if you can go test it out, if you can go investigate it empirically, if you can know it by your five senses, those are the only kinds of statements that are true. And that view is self-defeating because it's a philosophical claim that cannot be, it's certainly not self-evident, it's not true by definition, and it's not something that can be investigated and confirmed empirically. So, but that's sort of a separate issue. The only reason I mention that is because a lot of people have this idea when it comes to God. It's like a strong empiricism. You know, unless I can touch God, see God, run some sort of science experiment, I can't really have knowledge about God. God's immaterial. God's a matter of religious opinion, and there's so much disagreement about all that. This is not a good reason to think that we cannot have knowledge of God. Just because God is immaterial, this doesn't mean that we can't know whether or not He exists. So another important point to consider about agnosticism is that in all of its forms, so we considered soft agnosticism and hard agnosticism, in both forms, but especially hard agnosticism, it has to assume that God either has not revealed Himself to humanity, or at the very least, He is unable to for some reason. And this is significant, because from a Christian viewpoint, God has revealed Himself through the world He made, through our conscience, through the Bible, and supremely through Jesus Christ. When you look at the Bible, it doesn't present a God who has not revealed Himself. And in fact, Paul states in Romans chapter 1 that God has made Himself known to such a degree that humanity is, quote, without excuse. This is from Romans chapter 1, verses 18 through 20, and I'll just read this here because it's worth quoting in full. Paul says, quote, "For God's wrath is revealed from heaven against all godlessness and unrighteousness of people who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth, since what can be known about God is evident among them because God has shown it to them. For His invisible attributes, that is, His eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen since the creation of the world, being understood through what He has made. As a result, people are without excuse." End quote. So the Bible's pretty clear there. People are without excuse, and God has revealed Himself. There's other places that we can go in the Bible to see that other writers also describe how Jesus Christ is the fullest revelation of God to humanity. So in John chapter 1, verse 18, John says this. He says, quote, "No one has ever seen God, the one and only Son, who is Himself God and is at the Father's side. He has revealed Him." End quote. So John is saying, Jesus, when you look at Jesus, you see the revelation of who God is. You see God Himself. We could also go to the book of Hebrews in the New Testament, chapter 1, verses 1 through 3. The author of Hebrews starts off this book by saying this, quote, "Long ago, God spoke to our fathers by the prophets at different times and in different ways. In these last days, He has spoken to us by His Son. God has appointed Him heir of all things and made the universe through Him. The Son is the radiance of God's glory and the exact expression of His nature, sustaining all things by His powerful word." End quote. So the author of Hebrews here is saying that God has revealed Himself to such an extent in the person of Jesus Christ. Jesus is the radiance of God's glory. He's the exact expression of His nature. So another way of saying that when you look at Jesus, you are beholding God Himself. because Jesus is God. Jesus reveals the Father. Jesus reveals to us who God is. So it is, if we take a Christian view of God seriously, it means that we have to reckon with the truth that God has taken the initiative to reveal himself to humanity in many ways, through what he's made in the world, through the universe, through our conscience, through who we are as human beings, and supremely through the person of Jesus Christ and his actions throughout history that the Bible records. God has also made us in his image, and so this means he's made us in such a way that we are capable of knowing him. So in contrast to a view like Schellenberg's and other people who may promote a strong version of agnosticism, there is not a great ditch between humanity and the knowledge of God. God has revealed himself. God has made a way for us to know him in the person of Jesus Christ. And we've also seen that philosophically, hard agnosticism just does not hold up to critical scrutiny. And so if philosophically this view does not hold up, and then theologically it doesn't hold up, these are both indicators and a case that shows that hard agnosticism is just not a good reason to reject the existence of God. So we've talked about in this episode how agnosticism can come in two forms. You can have soft agnosticism, which says that someone is just personally not sure if God exists or not, but they're open to the possibility that there could be a God, and they're willing to investigate that and to think about it. And then hard agnosticism is the claim that no one can know whether or not God exists. And we talked about some reasons to think that hard agnosticism is not a good objection. And the first reason was that this view is self-defeating. The second way is that in many ways, this view rests on a misunderstanding of probability and on how to evaluate claims. And we discussed that whole idea of the infancy of humanity and why this logic really doesn't work to cast doubt on the ability of us to know or to have knowledge of God. And then we talked about how the concept of God, that God is immaterial, the fact that there's disagreement about God, those are not good reasons to embrace hard agnosticism either, because you have disagreement in science, you have disagreement in history, and people don't think that we can't know anything in those disciplines. So, and that one of the chief reasons is that this view is not a good reason to reject the possibility of knowledge of God is that God has revealed himself, at least according to the Bible. So we covered a lot in this episode. I hope that it was helpful for you. And once again, if this is a podcast that you enjoy and are helped by, please feel free to leave a positive review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get the show from. Tell others about it. And remember that there is reason for hope in Jesus Christ.